Welcome to Civil Discourse. This podcast will use government documents to illuminate the workings of the American government and offer context around the effects of government agencies in your everyday life. And now your hosts, Nia Rogers, Public Affairs Librarian, and Dr. John Augenbaugh, Political Science Professor.
Hey, Augie.
Good morning, Nia. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. I'm looking forward to our conversation today, of course.
Too, because I am, I have questions about disasters. And you and I have a history of Homeland Security and emergency preparedness work. And in this instance, I am not talking so much about the Homeland Security part as I am the emergency preparedness part,
yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Sort of the idea of what happens during the disaster and the specific disasters that I'm curious about, and I'm curious about how they get paid for, are the big disasters like the Exxon Valdez, or the Deepwater Horizon. Those are both in the oil industry, but like if Bhopal had happened in the United States.
States, yes.
Instead of India, right? Like they got lucky that it happened in India in the sense that the Indian laws, I think, are a lot less restrictive.
Yes.
Than American laws. But yes. You and I briefly mentioned the Cuyahoga River being on fire in one of our previous episodes.
Yeah, when we were talking about the development of the EPA. Right. Yes.
And the waters of the United States, right? All of that stuff.
Yes.
Who's responsible for cleaning up when industry goes awry in that way?
Okay, so listeners, what we're talking about here, and we're going to use as our two primary examples, though, because it's both Nia and I will probably digress
tangent.
Into what, digress into other examples, but.
That won't happen.
It's kind of nice to know each other's pathologies
yes.
before we start a project, right? Okay, but we're using as our jumping off point, listeners, as Nia just mentioned, the Exxon Valdez and the Deepwater Horizon. Both of these were oil spills. Okay, with the Exxon Valdez, that was the name of a ship. That ran aground off the Alaskan coastline. And at the time, Nia, do you recall the year? Exxon Valdez was 1989.
Yeah, should be noted, by the way, that I think the ship's name was, I think that all of Exxon's ships had Exxon something.
Something.
Right, Valdez, like that was their naming practice was
yes.
Exxon being the company that owned the oil company that owned the ship. And then the ship's technical name, Valdez, and I don't remember who it was named for or anything like that. Sorry, I should have learned that stuff, but I didn't. But Exxon ships, kind of like Evergreen, the one that got caught in the Suez Canal, all of their ships are Evergreen something. It's not, you can't just call it the Evergreen because Evergreen is the name of the company. And that's a quick way for other ships to know whose ship that is.
Yes. You know,
that
who
has
is the
shown
only,
up someplace.
Yeah. In the aftermath of the Exxon Valdez disaster, Exxon paid close to $4 million in cleanup costs and restoration of habitat.
Okay. So, but the Exxon Valdez, so it went and got oil in Alaska,
yes.
Right? And it was just in the hold of the ship. It was not in
it was not in barrels yet. Yep.
It was just poured in, essentially.
Yep.
Okay. And then they're leaving Alaska. They're leaving Prince William Sound.
Yes.
Right? Do-do-do, like you do, sailing along, spoosh, spoosh, spoosh.
Yep.
And they hit a bunch of rocks.
Yes.
A known hazard. So it embroiled in this question was the captain sober? when this when this accident occurred? That was one of the questions. Another of the questions was, why weren't their navigation maps working? And by the way, 1989 is before you have strong GPS and that kind of thing. But why weren't their navigation maps up to date? Why didn't they know that this known hazard, that they were coming close to this known hazard? So there was also some question about the training of the officers, not just the the captain, but of it. Right. So there's lots of questions about the Valdez in and of itself that are separate from the accident, but that have a question about Exxon and its hiring practices and its training practices. So then you get this, it hits the rocks and it spills.
I went ahead and looked that up. Well, it had collected 53 million gallons of crude oil. And I think they pretty much lost the entire contents.
11 million? I think they lost 11 million. They 11 lost
million.
A fifth of what was in the ship.
That's right. Yep.
But keep in mind, too, crude oil is not the gasoline that you see at the tank. Crude oil is this thick, gooey stuff that has not yet been to a refinery.
That's right.
So it's oil as the dinosaurs made it.
Yeah,
by going out and dying somewhere.
Yeah, it's in its natural state. It's not yet been refined. And
so when it spills, it's not like, oops, oh, that'll be easy to clean up.
It just lays there, okay, and again. It requires quite a bit of scientific, if you will, know-how to go ahead and first collect it, and then you have to engage in cleanup. And at that time, you know, some of the techniques that were used for the cleanup, what we've now come to find out, those techniques actually did more ecological damage than if we just had let it lay there.
Yeah, okay? I saw that in your notes and I'm fascinated by that. So 1,300 miles of coastline were affected.
Yeah.
For anybody wondering how far 13 miles is, if you started driving in Richmond, you would get to, I think, just beyond the Grand Canyon. Like, it's a long distance. That is a lot of coastline to try to clean up.
And for those listeners who've never been to Alaska, I mean, Alaska is huge.
Right.
Okay. And it's, you know, got significant coastline. Okay?
And by coastline, they also mean islands. A huge number of the inlets and lakes and rivers in Alaska all have islands in them. So they brought in
high pressure, like local, hot water hoses,
but it was local combination of local and federal response, right? It wasn't just,
it wasn't
just Exxon.
No,
it was a combined effort.
Yeah. This was a combined, public private sector response. I mean, researchers are still trying to figure out the damage. And I know this is, you know, 2022 when we're recording this episode.
You know, so 34 years.
Yeah, 33, 34 years. But I mean, it was just catastrophic.
And it was so sad. You saw lots of pictures on the news of birds. Like if they land in it, because they can only fly so far, if they land in it, then they get covered in goo and then they have to be cleaned individually and moved to another part of the coastline where they're safe. And
again, crude oil is thick. It's viscous. Okay.
I can't imagine that it was good for people or animals.
And small birds. Okay. You know, one of the reasons why they can fly like they do is because they are lightweight. right?
Right.
So, you know, they don't have the physical capability of being able to just, you know, throw off the oil.
Right.
Okay.
I didn't even think about that, but yeah.
I mean, okay. It becomes a weight that holds them down. Okay.
Which will eventually mean they starve to death.
They starve to death. That's right.
Right.
Now, the second disaster, the Deepwater Horizon.
Wait.
You're not ready to move on yet.
I'm not, because I have a couple of questions about Exxon. Okay. So all Exxon right. paid some money towards the cleanup costs, right?
Yeah. Yep. I think the total was close to, what was it? $4 billion.
Yep. Okay. And they didn't clean up the entire thing.
No.
Right? They left spots so that we could see what happens when, I don't know, a ship runs aground and spills a bunch of oil, because we didn't know what was going to happen. Like, we didn't know what that meant for.
Well, this was actually part of the court order consent decree. Some researchers wanted a part of the damaged area to not be cleaned up so they could research how quickly the environment recovered on its own.
But okay. You mentioned that one of the things that they used was, like, one of the things that they figured out they could use was high pressure hot water.
Yes.
To try to disperse it. You cannot soak it up. You can soak up some of it, and you can scoop up some of it, but the rest of it you have to disperse. And what you're trying to do there is make the part per million in water lower and lower and lower until it's less deadly.
That's right.
To marine life. But didn't they figure out that super hot, high pressure water actually kills other kinds of marine life that would have?
Yes.
That would have survived the initial problem?
Yeah, because the hot, okay, so you're talking about the ecology in a part of the country, the part of the world that is cold for most of the year. So all of a sudden you're using high pressure hot water in areas that have slow moving waters that are cold.
Okay. So instead of feeling like a spa, that felt like you'd been dropped into a pot of boiling water.
Yes.
Okay. Yep.
A pot of boiling water that, by the way, was being, if you will, shoved at you very quickly.
Right.
Okay.
So you were drinking out of a hot fire hose.
Yes.
And wondering why your lips are falling off, right? Like, because that's,
I mean, it's okay, kind of sort of so like when you, it's kind of sort of like really me when you get into the shower and you turn it on as hot as it can to get the shower going, but then you forget to go ahead and dial it back.
And you get under it.
Okay. And again, depending on how you have your shower head set, it could be blasting away at your neck and your back. Okay. And, you know, your body just like goes into shock.
Right. Cause you can't handle that. You're not.
Yeah, you can't handle it because that's not what you're used to. Right.
Right.
And that's what we're talking about in regards to the ecology there. Okay. They wanted to disperse this thick crude oil, but in the process, what they used harmed the ecology.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah.
So, but they left some of it and I guess, like, what we've figured out now is that in a few years, the environment sort of heals itself. It sort of recovers.
Yeah. In the Mearns Rock area, they left it largely as it was after the spill. And they found that mussels, barnacles, various seedweeds actually returned to normal levels after roughly 3 to 4 years after the spill.
Okay. So it could be considered an argument for not doing something, although
or coming up with different techniques.
Right.
I mean, and that's the other thing. Nia and I both know this because, again, of our background in emergency preparedness. A lot of what we now determine is best practice is because we tried other things in the past and they didn't work out. Okay.
Right.
It's kind of sort of trial and error. Right.
Maybe this will work. Nope. Maybe this will work. Maybe this will work. Did it cover most of the cost? Did that $4
billion? Yeah. Yep. Yep.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So, and I know we're going to talk about Deepwater Horizon, and then we're going to talk about some of the sort of more philosophical questions. So yeah, because, I will get to that later because
there are some philosophical issues here that I think interest me and I for this particular podcast episode, but they are of significant interest in disciplines like emergency preparedness,
public administration,
and even for that matter, business administration.
And environmental protection.
Environmental protection, et cetera. And right. These are some, you know, large philosophical questions that we hope to get to with this podcast episode and perhaps get you all to think about them. So
21 years later, platform in the Gulf.
Yes.
This the was Deepwater Horizon.
Yeah, Deepwater Horizon. This was your classic, if you will, oil platform in the middle of a body of water. Because what we've determined over the years is off the coast of, Louisiana, for instance, California, okay, there are deep reserves of petroleum. So you build a platform in the water, okay, and you drill down to get the oil because that's where the oil might be, right?
Right.
So you have this.
And the platform is usually what, like a story or two above the surface of the water?
Yes.
So you have these four big legs.
Yes.
That go down into the body of water, which is why we don't do this in the Pacific or the Atlantic. Very far off the coast,
yes.
Because they are significantly deeper. Your legs would have to be miles long,
yes.
Instead of probably what the 2 miles or so that it is in the Gulf. And that, who knows where the technology will take us in the future, what we might be able to, but part of what you do that for is stability, because then you have all this equipment on top of it and you have living quarters and food and all kinds of stuff on there. I mean, the platform is huge and it's like a city. It's like a small town.
It's like a small town. And remember too, folks, we're talking about the Gulf of Mexico. So you're talking about an area of the world that is prone for at least 2 to 3 months every year of some devastating hurricanes.
Right.
Okay.
So it's got to be built pretty well.
Yeah.
And the platform itself was not the problem. Well, it became the problem.
It became the problem, right.
But okay. It wasn't, because it did catch fire. But that was not.
No, the initial problem
was. That
was
not the initial problem.
It was the crack in the pipes, okay, drawing out the oil, okay?
Right. There
was, they just had
So. Go ahead. Okay, so for those who don't understand, let's briefly. So what happens is you sink a tube down through the earth, and you pull out the rock as you're sinking that tube. And when the tube hits oil, then you put in another tube, and inside that tube is the vacuum suction. This is very simplified. I can hear oil executives screaming right now across the planet that I don't know what I'm talking about. But that's a super simplified thing.
There are a bunch of engineers right now who are like...
They're just weeping. And I'm sorry I made you cry. But anyway, you suck the stuff out. And then when you're ready to move on, because what happens is pockets of oil, sort of, you get to the end of the usefulness of the pocket of oil. And when it's on land, you can do what's called fracking, which is you can explode things and force more oil out of the shale. Yes. But in the water, we don't frack. We have not yet figured out that technology. And with any luck, we won't. Because God help us, fracking in the ocean. But anyway, then what happens is they pull out that inner tube and then they try to close off.
Yeah, they try to cap
that
the well.
That original well tube, they try to cap. And that's where this became a problem was. So once they realized they had a crack, then they were like, oh, well, we'll just cap it, right? We'll just cap it and then that'll solve the problem. And so they put a cap on it and it went bloosh, 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 and continued to leak no one is certain the amount per day, because BP was like, yeah, it's leaking like 25 gallons a day. And it was actually leaking 1,000 or 100 times that or something, 500 times. Yeah, it was like,
it's considered the largest marine oil spill in the history of the petroleum industry.
Right.
So that's around the world.
Because what happens is that surfaces. It doesn't sink to the bottom.
No. Nope.
It's lighter than the water, so it surfaces. It's still gooey and terrible. Surfaces, and then it makes what's called a slick across the top of the water.
Yes.
And then the slick, because of waves, gets driven up onto the shore. And then that's how you get, like, the Valdez was really close to shore, relatively speaking. So it had a lot less problem with the oil getting there. Right. But because the Gulf, that slick was, it was like 10 miles long or something. It was some horrible.
It covered the coastline of three states. Louisiana, Mississippi, and a part of Alabama. Okay.
I mean, it's crazy. It's crazy how
it not only devastated wildlife, it basically shut down the economies of coastal communities in those three states.
Right. Because guess where you get your shrimp from in the South? You get it off of the Louisiana coast.
Okay, so the fishing industry.
Even if you could get clean shrimp, nobody wanted to eat them because they were afraid of it, right?
That's
like
right.
It had devastating effects financially.
And then all the tourist areas, okay?
Oh, yeah, let's go to the beach and hang out in the oil. Wait, what? No, what? That's a terrible idea.
Yeah, right? Okay. So, what was it? British Petroleum.
So then they had a fire on the
platform.
So then the platform caught fire.
Yes. Yeah.
And then it was found that the platform didn't have enough ways for people to get off the platform, safely.
Yep.
So like this was, and I forgive, please, my language. I'm going to actually curse. So trigger warning. This was a shit show start to finish.
Yes.
Because the well wasn't handled well. The closing wasn't, the capping wasn't handled well, and then the thing exploded and caught fire. Like,
yes.
And I mean, lots of people died. Like, this was not a small, I mean, the
what is it?
Self caused death, which Valdez did not. Valdez didn't actually.
That's correct.
Nobody on the Valdez died.
No. But there were 11 counts of manslaughter that British Petroleum, BP, pled guilty to. Two misdemeanors, and for good measure, they also pled to a felony count of lying to Congress. Because afterwards, they at least attempted for a short period of time to cover up, all the wrongdoing.
Right.
Okay.
We got the cap under control. There's no problem. And then the big giant fire happened, they were like, I wonder how that happened. Like, I can't remember who the guy who was in charge of BP. I don't remember his name. Tony. Go ahead.
Well, Nia goes in and looks that up.
Yeah, because I got to know now.
Okay.
Sorry.
Yeah. And And listeners, this is the
Tony segue. Hayward.
Tony. Oh, yeah, that's right. Tony
Hayward. Tony Hayward, who said, I'm having a really bad day to the reporters. Like, really? You're having a bad day.
Day.
11 people are dead.
Dead.
The entire coastlines of a whole bunch of states are oily and slicky and gross. Animals are dying left, right, and center. Industries are falling apart. And you're having a bad day.
Yes.
Perhaps, Mr. Hayward, you have chosen poorly in what you said to reporters.
Yes. You know, there are bad days and then there are bad days. Mr. Hayward, okay, you're not even on our bad day scale right now. Okay.
Right.
Okay. So,
like, dude.
But so, first of all, BP agreed to pay a fine to the US government of over $4.5 billion. Okay.
Okay.
Then BP agreed to cover all the costs related to cleanup, charges, and various penalties to both the federal government and various state governments for violating environmental laws. That total was $65 billion. BP then also agreed to set up a fund that was administered by a special master, okay, to compensate all of the businesses, okay, who basically had to close down because of the oil spill. Okay.
Right.
Now,
what's interesting is BP pleaded guilty to 11 counts of manslaughter.
Yeah.
Right? Like, they were treated like a person in the legal sense of, so people who get angry about some of the SCOTUS decisions where, like Citizens United, I'm thinking, right, where corporations are treated as people, and we don't like that. We loved it in the case of BP because they were held responsible. They were held.
That's right.
And in fact, in one of, I think they were also banned from having any contracts, right? Like,
yes,
they lost money. They lost opportunity. The government did actually say, you can't just destroy the Gulf and walk away. That's not how. That's not how this works.
This is not how it works. Okay. And actually, Nia, it's funny you mentioned that, because occasionally I'll have students who are critical, as you just mentioned, because American courts have, in certain contexts, allow corporations to be classified under the law as individuals. And I say,
right.
Okay.
For Citizens United, it was about campaign funds, I think. That right?
Yeah. In the Citizens United case, the Supreme Court said federal law could not restrict what corporations and political action committees spent on campaigning.
Right.
Because they
everybody's all grumpy. They're not people, they're corporations.
The First Amendment protects individual rights, not corporate rights.
Right.
And I said, okay, well, if corporations aren't individuals, then all of the various criminal statutes at the state and federal level that make corporations legally liable for criminal wrongdoing, we got to throw those out because corporations aren't individuals. And of course, my students are like, no. And I said, oh, so there should be an exception for criminal wrongdoing. And they're
or
like,
for
yeah.
campaign donations.
And
right?
They're like, yeah. And I said, so we have a consistency of principle issue here.
Right. Which, by the way, is where we get into the philosophy of these questions, which is,
yes,
is this idea of being held responsible. Now, the first thing I want to say, I want to go on record saying, is do not mistake paying, setting up funds, doing all those things for corporations being good citizens, because they
correct
are not. They did that because, one, they were compelled by the government, and two, because they wanted their reputation, they wanted to heal their reputations.
Yes.
After the Exxon Valdez, people wouldn't buy gas at Exxon stations. Like, yes, they were mad at Exxon. The same thing happened after Deepwater with BP. My friends, my social justice warrior friends, were like, I will never buy BP gas again. And I'm like,
my friend said the same thing.
Okay, that's fine. But now all of that seems to have been forgotten, at least in my friend group, because it's been long enough. This was 2010. And now it's 12 years later, and my friends are like, I get gas wherever's close to me. Because it's really hard to maintain being angry at a company, especially when the company rehabilitates its image.
Yeah, so Nia, to your point, listeners, let's be very clear about this. Neither Nia nor I, are trying to give Exxon or BP a pass here.
Oh, heck no.
Okay, because they were not good corporate citizens. In both of these cases, okay, I mean, for instance,
they lied.
I mean, they lied in court proceedings and they got caught. Okay. Right.
They tried to hide what had happened. Like they
tried to hide what had happened. There was evidence in both cases, particularly the BP case, where BP execs knew for years that there were issues with not only the deep water platform, but a number of their platforms, right?
Yeah, and they knew that their subcontractors were crap. Like they chose the cheapest people in the industry, which guess what? You get what you pay for.
Yes, right?
Right. Okay. They knew of the negligence, and Exxon knew of the negligence of the captain and didn't, but Deepwater is far deeper. Like that negligence went, I think, a lot further.
Further, okay. But in both of these instances, what arose and scholars began to ask, is to what extent should the government, and when I say the government, I'm talking about multiple levels of government, right? Okay, both federal and state. Because remember with, Exxon Valdez, it was right off the coast of Alaska. You know, it's been basically the stated policy of numerous Alaskan state governments to pursue as much extraction of petroleum from Alaskan lands as possible, right? Likewise with, the Gulf of Mexico, the states of Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama, but particularly Louisiana, have consciously chosen over multiple decades to pursue economic development based on petroleum and chemical extraction.
Exactly. They benefit. They benefit as states. So where the question comes in for us and what we're bringing this as far as government is concerned is if the government's job is to encourage an industry, right? And it is because in almost every industry except industries where it's just the point of like killing people, which is there is no industry of that. But in every other industry, the reason the government is supposed to pursue them is because they create jobs and they bring money to the local economy. And they, right, there's all these things that happen when you have good local industry or rather robust local industry.
Yeah.
So local government is going to pursue that in every instance. In every single instance, they are going to do that. You know why? Because we tell them to. We as taxpayers and electors and
voters
tell them that's what we want. We want you to
bring us jobs.
We want you to bring money into our economy. We want to improve our schools. And
we want a diverse
roads.
Tax base, because if we have a diverse tax base, then none of us individually, gets socked
to pay
with
that burden. Right.
Yeah, has to get socked with high tax rates. Okay, and this is what we tell our elected officials.
And right? then we also say we want you to regulate them and make sure that they don't do pooky things to the water so that we can't go swimming in the Gulf of Mexico for the next 15 years.
That's
and
right.
The government's like, okay, those are competing
imperatives.
Right. Yeah, like, thank yes. you, competing imperatives.
Yes, right. I mean,
how would you like us to encourage all this and absolutely guarantee your safety? We cannot do that. We can't do both things.
And this is where, you know, scholars, particularly in emergency preparedness and in public administration, have gone ahead and started asking some of these questions. Like, okay, what is the government liability or responsibility for some of these disasters when for years, you know, for instance, I'll just focus on the petroleum industry in the United States.
Yeah, we could mention tobacco. We're looking at you. Chemicals, we're looking at you.
You, asbestos.
Like, yeah, okay. I mean, we're looking at all of y'all, but we're picking on oil right now. Just know that we have you in our side eye.
Yeah, right? Okay.
You have not escaped our notice, but we are talking about others.
But just using the petroleum industry in the United States, what many Americans don't recognize is that for decades, the United States Congress, okay, provided tax breaks for petroleum companies to
explore,
right?
Right. Go and find pockets of oil because we like it and we want more of it.
And we want to be, quote unquote, energy independent.
Right.
And India, at the time we're recording this podcast episode, energy independence is once again raised its ugly head in American politics because the West is concerned that there's a madman in Russia who might turn off all of Russia's oil and gas output to the West, right?
Right.
And the United States gets some of its oil from, wait for it, Russia.
It's so, not huge. It's about 3%, but still.
But okay, you know, you take 3%.
I'm going to ask all Americans to drive 3% less. They're going to say, wait, what? I'm not going to do that.
Okay. So you got the United States federal government encouraging petroleum companies to find, you know, new wells of petroleum. Okay.
Do I get to say it?
Go for it.
Drill, baby, drill.
Drill, that's right. Drill, baby, drill.
Drill, baby, drill. There's another whole industry thing, of t-shirts.
Okay, here's another element. The federal government then also provided subsidies for oil companies to build petroleum refinery plants.
Right.
So once you pull up the petroleum out of the ground, then you have to refine it for the various uses, right? And primarily gasoline and vehicles, but nevertheless. So at the same time, we're encouraging the industry to engage in various activities. We also want the government to regulate it. Right.
And we want, like we say, drill, baby, drill, right, in Alaska. And then we say to the EPA, protect moose, baby, protect moose.
That's right.
Right. And that is a lot harder t-shirt to wear, by the way. But it's like those two things. And the reason,
by the way, listeners, that will be part of our growing swag and merchandise line.
Protect okay. moose, baby, moose, protect baby moose.
Yes, right.
Because the thing that, and one of the reasons Augie and I want to talk about this is that, like so many things in politics, this is a divisive issue that is nuanced. And this idea that you could have any conversation about it without maintaining your civility, as we have talked about, without recognizing that both sides have a point, right? If we have built a society, which we have, on the American car and car ownership and the idea of freedom, right? And the wind in your hair and driving down the road. And,
you know, you've had a rough day, Nia, okay? You've had a rough work week, okay? You know, this is part of the American myth, right? You wake up on a Saturday morning, you get in your car.
And you go somewhere.
You drive someplace.
Right. Or you're old and on Sunday you go to church and then you go for a little drive afterwards.
That's right.
Where you drive along the roads at very slow paces where I'm behind you yelling at you.
Yeah. So the infamous, oftentimes criticized by other drivers, Sunday drive.
Okay? Right. Okay. So we encourage that as a society and as a culture. And then we also say, yeah, but I don't want you to hurt anything while you're doing that. Okay, well, but when you have an accident, millions of animals die.
Yes.
Because, and millions of miles of, or thousands of miles rather, of coastline are destroyed.
Yes.
And that's wetlands and all kinds
endangered species.
Right.
Okay, and ecosystems that took thousands of years to develop, okay,
right. And we trash in,
yeah, we destroy in less than 24 hours,
right.
So the question becomes, what should be prioritized?
Exactly.
Right? I mean, it's kind of sort of like I've had this conversation, Nia, and I think you have too, friends of ours who were born and raised in Europe that have less of an emphasis on an automobile lifestyle, right?
Right.
They have great subway systems and public transportation systems, and they have laws and rules that require, you know, high density within urban areas, et cetera.
And they make oil expensive there. Gasoline,
yes, okay.
Petrol, as they call it, as my friends in England call it, is enormously expensive there.
Expensive.
It makes you think about whether you're just going to get in a car and go for a ride. You're probably not going to do that.
Not going to do that. But there are trade-offs, okay?
Right.
Because their tax rates are significantly higher than those in the United States, in part because they have to maintain, you know, these well-developed, elaborate, okay, excellent public transportation systems.
Exactly.
Right?
I say all the time that I would love to have a light rail system in Richmond.
Yes.
And then somebody says, well, that's going to cost you. And I'm like, gulp. Right. Like I'm willing to pay that, but it will be painful. It will be something I have to think about.
And
you're right.
And who should bear the cost?
Right.
Right.
Is that users? Do just users pay for buses? No, we all pay for buses.
Buses, okay. Because, you know, if we're going to force the users, many of the users are poor people who cannot afford, okay, automobiles, etc.
Right.
So who bears the cost, right? So you're going to tell somebody, okay, that they can't use their car as much, or if they do, it's going to cost them more to pay for a system they don't use that will be frequented or used by a whole bunch of other people. Okay.
Well, and then you get the
good
cycle
luck
of
getting elected on that
exactly.
policy platform.
You also get the cycle of ridership is low, so there's no reason to build out more. So we don't build out more, so ridership is low, right? Like it's
a chicken or egg type argument.
Exactly.
Right?
It's a big circle that comes around and around and around in public administration and government, is this idea of how do we balance these two things? And when something goes horrifically wrong, whose fault is it?
I mean, because Nia, and you saw this in the notes that I wrote up for this podcast episode, there are actually some public administration scholars who, you know, say, yes, most of the blame should be on Exxon and British Petroleum. But you have some public administration scholars who are like, well, where's the government's culpability in this?
Right.
They had the legal authority delegated to various agencies by Congress to regulate the petroleum industry, specifically the Department of Energy. But what they found, okay, is in many cases, the regulators, okay, were in very close working relationships with guess who?
The regulated, right.
Those who are supposed to be regulated.
Well, and the way that works is an oil executive is appointed to be the head of the energy department.
The Department of Energy, right?
They're the head of the Department of Energy for 4 to 8 years, depending on the presidency. And when they are booted out, guess where they go? Back to the oil industry.
That's right. Okay.
But they are not, if they want a job, unless this is going to be their last job, which we may need to think about as a society, if that's what we want, is your last job, your being the head of an agency is your last job, and we just give you some kind of public support after that for financially so that you can't go back to those industries. Because if not, you're going to make regulations that those industries like so that they will hire you when your time in government is done. That's a natural thing that happens in political positions.
Well, Neil, let's just assume for a moment that kind of sort of crass, narrow self-interest of the former departmental head who goes back to work for the industry that they just regulated, let's just assume that that's not the motivation. Let's say you're the
At you being generous.
Well, okay. I'm playing devil's advocate here.
Okay.
Right? Okay.
So let's say
you're the head of the Department of Energy, right? And you know that at most you're going to have 8 years in office. You might have only four. Do you want to spend all 4 years, okay, in court because your quote unquote overzealous regulation of the industry, okay, is challenged every single time you issue a regulation? Or do you try to go ahead and find some common ground so you don't spend all 4 or 8 years, okay, with a whole bunch of headaches?
Well, and in fairness, change is usually best done incrementally because you can get more people on board for an incremental change than you can get for a radical change.
And moreover,
that's a fair point. Okay.
Okay. And when you talk about broad sweeping changes with industries, okay, you're talking about a whole bunch of people's lives, okay, who could be fundamentally changed in a short period of time.
That's true. Okay. If you suddenly came in with all right, fine, you're making a good argument. Okay, I hate it when you do that.
But again,
it makes sense to me that one of the things that a department head or an agency head would want to do would be to protect workers in the industry who it is not their fault. BP executives are vastly different from the dude who was working on the platform. Right. Like,
yes,
his ability to change that industry is nothing compared to their ability to change that industry. And yeah, I can see where he would need protection from an agency head or a department head. What can we do that will prevent that won't make these people instantly lose their jobs? How about we phase something out so they can transition to a different job so that they can still feed their families and this kind of goes back to
a more fundamental question, Nia, and I want listeners to go ahead and think about this. If we're going to have the modern administrative state where the government assumes more regulatory responsibility, then should the government also assume some of the legal responsibility when harm occurs? You understand the question, right? So, you know,
if you claim more regulatory power, are you also taking on responsibility for when those things don't work out? So let's use Deepwater as a thought example on that. So if the government had been all over BP with these platforms don't work and this thing doesn't work and that thing doesn't work and you need to get this fixed by tomorrow and blah, 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 blah.
And the government then signs off.
And BP had done it and the government signed off, or BP didn't do it, but the government signed off on their promise. Then would the $65 million have needed to come from the government?
65 billion, not million.
Billion, sorry. I was thinking just a moment. I was like, wait, that's too low.
But Nia, I'll go ahead and give you...
And yes, the answer would be yes, I think.
If yeah, I'll give you a more recent example with a phenomenon that listeners, Nia's mentioned a couple times to me off recording. Nia's fascinated by the driverless automobiles.
Oh my gosh, Nia hates this idea with the power of a thousand burning suns.
Okay, but.
Hear that, now, Elon Musk? You suck.
Okay.
Seriously, it's a terrible idea. It's a terrible idea unless all cars have it. So, but anyway, but that's a philosophical question we have for another day.
Okay, but we have driverless automobiles, and we've had various federal and state government agencies sign off on their use. But now, because we have more of those types of automobiles, we are now seeing accidents that are being caused. And some of the lawsuits have actually named these government agencies as defendants because the government agencies have at least given temporary or probationary, if you will, approval to their usage. Now, the government agencies are claiming in court filings that I've read so far, Nia, that the government can't be sued because the government didn't create the technology. Okay, all the government is tasked with doing is to make sure that they meet existing safety requirements. But those who have been injured have been said, are saying, you know, they're asking the question in court. But you are allowing these automobiles to be used on city streets, on highways. So if the government says they are safe and the industry is going forward by producing more of them and more consumers are buying them, okay, should not the government also be held responsible?
I think so. I mean, I think that if the government says, you know, if the government says that a Pinto is safe and someone taps you in the back of your Pinto and it explodes, the first people that are responsible, isn't it Ford? I think that was a Ford Pinto.
Yeah, Ford
Pinto. The first people who are responsible are Ford and Ford's engineers, but also the government regulators that said Pintos are safe because government regulator, like, if you make a car, you have to submit that to the government for safety issues. You don't get to just put a car on the road and say, ta-da, I made a car. That's not how that works. Because
it's the National Highway Safety and Transportation Board.
Yep. Right. They have to ensure that your model is safe for, you know, people to be in. So if it's not, so I can see where that argument could be made that if they said it was a safe thing.
What if the corporation?
Well, the FAA gets, I mean, is it the FAA that gets sued when airline?
Yes.
When there are airline crashes, and that's not an illegitimate thing.
But what if the corporation lied to the regulators?
Right. And that's what the regulators would have to prove. They'd have to prove that they were given, that they signed off on something that wasn't true. It's like Theranos, right? She said all those things that miracle things that she could do with a drop of blood and nobody got the proof for it. And so a whole bunch of people are liable because they didn't do due diligence. But if the government does due diligence and they are lied to, then I would say that would remove them from legal censure.
Yeah. So the liability. The liability is then, you know, separated or tenured.
But they'd have to prove they were lied to. They'd have to prove. Yes. Well, for instance, tobacco for years lied to the government and said, we have absolutely no proof that smoking causes cancer.
Yes.
When in fact, they had tons of proof that smoking causes cancer, but they told the regulators that it didn't until they couldn't get away with that lie anymore.
But of course, listeners, Nia just gave us another example of how the government at times, okay, is schizophrenic.
Right, has competing interests.
Yeah, has competing interests.
Because as a person who was raised on a tobacco, well, I wasn't raised on a tobacco farm, but my uncle owned a tobacco farm. He had subsidies. To raise tobacco.
So, and one agency of the federal government, the Surgeon General's office.
We'll give
office,
you a little money to raise this tobacco. And another agency says, don't do that. That kills people.
The Surgeon General's office went ahead and concluded in the late 1950s that tobacco caused cancer. Okay. And for easily another four decades, the United States Congress passed appropriations bills that gave subsidies for farmers to continue to grow tobacco.
Yep. Because the Southern lobby is powerful.
So, I mean, again, you know, listeners, there's not necessarily a correct answer here. And
right.
Once again, I cannot emphasize enough.
It is not cut and dried.
Okay, Exxon and BP, okay, deserved to pay all the fines, okay, all the cleanup costs, et cetera, et cetera.
Right, but how
pass.
Is it that they had a giant platform in the middle of the Gulf and the United States government did not know that it was a piece of crap that was going to fall over, catch fire, and kill 11 people? Like,
yes.
How is that a thing? The government, I'm falling into the category of the government should have been held
okay
somewhat liable for that.
Okay, because again, you know, the government is, you know, and we hear this all the time, listeners, right? Nia, you and I have talked about this. Okay, we have government officials that make claims that if you do X, then Y won't occur. The risk will be gone, right? Okay, and I know some of you who are listening are like, he's going to launch into another discussion of COVID-19. I could, but I won't, right? But we see this in all kinds of public policy areas.
Right.
Okay. But you can't remove the risk completely.
Right.
Okay.
And those jobs benefit thousands of families.
Yes.
And they are how they send their kids to college, and they are how they pay for their medical bills and their food and their shelter. Like, those are good paying jobs. So how do we, if we're not going to have those industries, what are we going to do with those folks? And how are we going to have them maintain a decent life?
Yeah.
But it's complicated. I think is what we're trying
You just talk about job creation. You know, there's a federal law, listeners, that Congress passed that I think President Truman signed into law that said, okay, one of the goals of the federal government budget is to provide, okay, employment for all Americans.
Really?
Yes. Okay. So when you have that, when you have the government make those kinds of claims in law, okay, it's not surprising that a bunch of people start relying on those claims, right?
Right.
Okay. I'm not going to tell listeners where I live in the Richmond area, but I live in a county outside of Richmond that says my drinking water is clean. Every time I turn on the tap, I rely upon that claim. But what happens when that's not the case? Think about all those people in Flint, Michigan. Okay.
Right.
So, I mean, these are some serious philosophical questions.
Yes,
right?
They are.
Okay. And in the, you know, our purpose, listeners, is not to go ahead and completely blow you all's minds or to make you completely risk adverse with what you do in your daily lives.
Yeah, don't go outside. That's what we're saying to you. Don't go outside. Don't do anything. Like, no, we're not saying that. But we're saying that it's not as simple as corporations are evil or the government is evil. Or you know what I mean? Like, there is no one bad guy.
There are so many trade-offs
right
in this discussion that oftentimes, Nia, I'm not entirely sure that we as American citizens, okay, are understanding the trade-offs that are involved, right?
And you know what helps with that? Listening to all the sides.
Yes, having conversations.
It helps to listen to all the sides and hear what they say they're responsible for and not responsible for, which will also help you figure out where the holes are in policy.
Yes.
Oh, we don't, nobody thinks that they're responsible for X thing, and turns out X thing is really dangerous.
And get you to re-examine what are your values and beliefs.
Right.
Okay.
And when you go into the polling booth, how are you representing those?
Yes. Okay. Because if you go ahead and believe that we should get out of automobiles and we should decrease our dependence on fossil fuels for energy, then perhaps you should, when you go to vote, throw your vote behind candidates who want to have, for instance, more robust public transportation systems.
Right.
Just a thought.
And you want to ask them in debates.
Yes.
What's your stand on, or when they come to your local, you know, you have a local town hall with that individual, what are you going to do about public transportation?
Yes.
And put them on the spot. Make them answer.
Okay. And how are they going to pay for it? Right.
Right.
You know, who's going to pay for it? Are you willing to accept that trade-off? Okay. But these are tough questions, right? And they all arise, you know, from, you know, this, as Nia, as you pointed out, this tension between, on one hand, the government is trying to encourage, you know, job growth, industries to do well, but at the same time, we want to minimize the, economists love this phrase, negative externalities of marketplace behavior. Okay, so how do you accomplish those two? Because a lot of times it forces you to make tough decisions. So,
right. Thanks, Augie. This has been a really good episode. It's been really interesting for me. And I hate when you make good points that I now have to go away and think about.
Well, occasionally I have them. Not all the time, but occasionally.
No, yes. I appreciate you giving me a different way to view that. So thank you.
Yeah.
And we'll talk again soon.
All right. Bye, Nia.
You've been listening to Civil Discourse, brought to you by VCU Libraries. Opinions expressed are solely the speaker's own and do not reflect the views or opinions of VCU or VCU Libraries. Special thanks to the workshop for technical assistance. Music by Isaac Hobson. Find more information at guides.library.vcu.edu/discourse. As always, no documents were harmed in the making of this